From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today, warfare to welfare. We take a look at how weapons manufacturer Lockheed Martin, the king of corporate welfare, profits from running government workfare programs. Also, 26 religious and peace activists are arrested outside the White House as they call for an immediate end to the bombings. Bishop Thomas Gumbelton of Detroit discusses the clergy's role in anti-war activism. And we continue with our daily War and Peace report from Belgrade with Pacifica's Jeremy Scahill. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm David Love. NATO warplanes struck targets across Serbia today, even as alliance generals began talks with their Yugoslav counterparts about withdrawing from Kosovo as agreed to by President Slobodan Milosevic. News of preliminary talks between NATO and Yugoslav generals on implementation of the peace deal accepted by Milosevic was revealed by British Prime Minister Tony Blair in an interview with the BBC. Alliance officials in Brussels said more formal talks between the two sides will start this weekend to draw up a timetable for withdrawals, as stipulated by the peace draft. The plan, accepted by Milosevic and the Serb parliament yesterday, contained tough conditions he had until now adamantly resisted, including the deployment of NATO troops on Yugoslav soil and the total withdrawal of his security forces. It offers Yugoslavia even less control of its southern province than a plan rejected only 3 months ago, and Milosevic's opponents are asking why he didn't strike a deal before the country was devastated in NATO attacks. Foreign ministers from Russia and the seven major industrialized democracies that put together the plan will meet on Sunday to work out points of a tentative UN Security Council resolution formally empowering the plan. Although withdrawals are a key condition for ending their 11-week air campaign, NATO officials have said they want to see verifiable evidence that they have begun, not just agreement that it will happen. Alliance warplanes continued their pounding of Serbian targets in keeping with that stance. Riding on a massive election victory, the African National Congress could emerge today with a two-thirds majority in parliament, giving it the power to amend South Africa's constitution. That possibility alarms opposition parties, particularly white ones. But the successor to Nelson Mandela, ANC President Thabo Mbeki, sought to reach out to whites in his victory speech. The biggest winner in Wednesday's vote was South African democracy itself. In only the second democratic elections, previously under apartheid, blacks were denied the vote. Millions of South Africans patiently waited in lines for hours, even in areas that 5 years ago were racked by violence. International observers hailed the election's freeness and fairness. Meanwhile, the UN mission in East Timor formally began its work yesterday, promising to remain neutral while preparing for a referendum on the territory's future. Several thousand independent supporters jammed the entrance of the mission's office when it opened, with a staff of 70 people and growing. Carrying pro-independence signs and screaming slogans such as Viva East Timor, the crowd, mostly young men, gathered as UN Mission Chief Ian Martin raised the UN flag outside the new headquarters. UN security officers and police scrambled to keep the crowd from overrunning the compound. The August 8th referendum will ask East Timorese to decide whether the territory should become an autonomous state within Indonesia or go its own way as a nation. In London today, a judge set September 27th as the date for the start of extradition hearings against former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet. Spain has asked for Pinochet's extradition to answer charges of murder and torture during his 1973 to 1990 rule. He has been under house arrest in Britain since last October while his lawyers fight the proceedings. In New York, attorneys on both sides of the trial of four white police officers accused of depriving a black Haitian immigrant of his civil rights agree on one point. Officer Justin Volpe committed a heinous crime. Now a jury must decide if he acted alone. The jury of seven men and five women were expected to begin deliberating today in a case that has strained relations between people of color and police and has sparked demonstrations against brutality. Volpe confessed already that he attacked and sodomized Luima. If convicted, three of the four remaining officers, Belomo, Weiss, and Bruder, face up to 10 years in prison. The fourth officer, Officer Schwartz, because of his charges involved a sexual assault, would face a maximum of life without parole. And in San Francisco, two state police agencies were named yesterday in a lawsuit demanding an end to racial profiling, the use of race or color to decide who is stopped by officers on the highway. The federal lawsuit was filed by the American Civil Liberties Union against the California Highway Patrol and the State Bureau of Narcotics Enforcement. And these are some of the headlines. Reporting for Democracy Now!, I'm David Love.
Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Juan Gonzalez. Amy Goodman will be joining us shortly. Today we begin with our daily War and Peace report. NATO military representatives could go to Yugoslavia as soon as tomorrow for preliminary talk on implementing a Kosovo peace plan accepted by the Balkan nation, an aide to Russian envoy Viktor Chernomyrdin said today. However, NATO planes are still bombing Yugoslavia, and the alliance, as well as Russia, have both reacted cautiously to Yugoslavia's decision to accede to Western demands over Kosovo. Diplomats say NATO could stop bombing Yugoslavia as soon as Sunday if Belgrade agrees with the alliance military planners on how to implement the international peace deal for Kosovo. Halting the bombing by Sunday would ease the way for foreign ministers of the group of eight nations, that's the group of seven Western industrial nations plus Russia, to approve a draft UN Security Council resolution on a Kosovo settlement. Russia and China have demanded that NATO halt the bombing before the Security Council discusses a resolution. Both Moscow and Beijing have the power to veto any Security Council resolution on the conflict. We're now joined by Pacifica's Jeremy Scahill, who continues his daily reports from Belgrade. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jeremy.
Thank you, Juan.
Jeremy, what are people saying about the agreement now that it has been, in essence, moved forward from the vote in the Yugoslav legislature yesterday?
Well, the official spin on it is that it preserves the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Yugoslavia, that it keeps Kosovo as part of the country, and that essentially the Milosevic government has gotten what it's been demanding all along, a UN presence, a UN security presence within the country. However, people on the streets are now, a day after the agreement, aware of the particulars of this agreement, and many people believe that it's worse than the Rambouillet Accords from Rambouillet, France, just a few months ago. They recognize that now NATO has the go-ahead to bring in 48,000 NATO troops into Kosovo and 10,000 Russian troops, which is a much worse deal than they would have gotten at Rambouillet. People very much consider this part of the picture of an occupation of the country. It also greatly reduces, this current agreement, the number of Serb forces that are allowed to remain in the country. Rambouillet would have preserved pre-war levels, somewhere in the ballpark of 10 to 11,000 Yugoslav forces within Kosovo. Now they're talking in the hundreds, not the thousands, and they're going to be restricted to liaison work, to trying to identify where minefields are, to guarding Serb monuments, and also to patrolling the borders. So the main question a lot of people on the streets here are asking is why? Why has the country suffered for 11 weeks under intensive bombing when we could have just signed Rambouillet and gotten a better deal at the beginning? It doesn't make sense to people. They feel that it's a complete capitulation to NATO demands, and on top of that, they've suffered for 11 straight weeks of heavy, heavy bombing in which the civilian infrastructure has been devastated, the electrical supply has been practically wiped out, the water supply is threatened, the environment is severely damaged, People are very, very somber and sad, and they also don't believe that the bombing is going to end. They have no faith in NATO. They have no trust in NATO. And the fact that this agreement was signed, many people felt that it was a step in the right direction toward ending the bombing, a step in the wrong direction toward preserving the sovereignty of Yugoslavia, and that they don't believe that the bombing will end soon.
Jeremy, we're joined now by Amy. Amy Goodman is back from her appearance this morning on C-SPAN, on a call-in show there on C-SPAN. Welcome back, Amy.
Well, it's great to be with you, Juan, and also with Jeremy. And Jeremy, I just wanted to say something very interesting that happened on C-SPAN is a lot of the people who called in were military. And I would say there's no question that the overwhelming number of people who called in from around the country during Washington Journal, this daily morning show, were opposed to the bombing of Yugoslavia. And Brian Lamb, who's the founder of C-SPAN and is the anchor of that show, said that overall, the calls that come in are usually more than half against the war.
Well, that's interesting. And you know, this comes at a time when now we understand from Belgrade's side that they have already had discussions with NATO officials, with NATO generals. And the rumor here on the streets of Belgrade is that General Wesley Clark will be coming to Belgrade this weekend. So, and the position of Russia was that when those sorts of discussions start, then an end to the bombing is in sight. Now, those are sort of the official circles here. But on the streets, as I was saying to Juan earlier, many people don't trust NATO. They believe that NATO generals coming to the country is not necessarily a good sign. And some people say they have no right to enter the country because of what they've done to us.
Jeremy, one of the questions that rises in my mind, the settlement indicates that a part of the conditions of the agreement is that the KLA has to be disarmed. Now, we had a representative of the KLA on this week, and I asked him whether he was concerned that he was going to be used and the Kosovo Liberation Army was going to be used as a pawn in a grander political scheme. But now, already, just as they're being armed, already apparently the United States has agreed to disarm them. How critical do you think this is going to be to the Milosevic government, and what impact could this possibly have on scuttling or undermining the agreement if the KLA refuses to be disarmed?
Well, there has been one interesting development on the front in Kosovo. We learned today that the Serbian forces have been arming Albanians who are opposed to the KLA. And so that, there is a new sort of wing of the fighting between Serb-backed Albanians and other Albanians. So now people are killing each other off. I think many people don't believe that the KLA is going to be demilitarized, and they won't believe it until they see it. Now, I've also heard reports that members of the KLA are against this agreement, that they feel that they've been used, that they don't feel that their independence is being preserved. They don't feel that that's what NATO had fought for, and that so many lives have been taken. I think it's very difficult for any side here to declare victory except for NATO, because they've pummeled the country and they have done what many people believe they set out to do, destroy a major portion of the civilian infrastructure here.
Jeremy, yesterday you had a chance to go to a news conference of the grassroots opposition. Can you explain the difference between that and the formal opposition and what they're saying?
Yeah, you have the mainstream opposition parties that are very, very closely linked not only to the U.S. and to other so-called Western countries, but they're also linked closely to the Milosevic government. Take Vuk Drašković, for instance. He's the head of the largest mainstream opposition party here, the Serbian Renewal Movement. And, of course, we've had his voice on Democracy Now! In the past. Well, he was part of the Milosevic government up until the first month of this bombing, when he called for the very sort of agreement that was signed yesterday. Well, he was part of that government, and others in the opposition movement, particularly the grassroots activists here, felt that he was co-opted by the Milosevic government, and that has wiped out his credibility as being someone who is so-called pro-democracy. Now, the Civic Alliance of Serbia is perhaps the only grassroots official party in the country. It's made up of leading intellectual dissidents, lawyers, and human rights workers, and they were the group that was responsible for leading the legal battle that led to the recognition of the elections in 1996 after Milosevic had annulled those elections. They also boycotted the elections in 1997, so they don't have a presence in the parliament. Their reaction to this was that, why have we suffered for so long and so hard, and so many of our people have died, if they were just going to sign an agreement that's worse than Rambouillet in the first place? Then below that layer of the Civic Alliance, closer to the grassroots, you have organizations like Women in Black and other NGOs and human rights groups who have been completely pushed underground here. They're afraid to come out because they say that our primary mission is democracy in this country. And if we can't talk about that openly and publicly, then we're silenced completely. And we face charges of treason and other things. Now, interestingly, today, the head of another opposition party, the Democratic Party here, he was indicted by Yugoslavia for draft evasion. He is currently right now in exile in Montenegro, but we learned today that he was indicted for draft evasion. Other heads of the party have conceded to the draft and have joined the Yugoslav military despite the fact that they are against the position of the Milosevic government. But it's important for listeners to know that when we talk about an opposition movement here, we're not talking about a democratic opposition as so many newspapers and television stations report. When we're talking about a democratic opposition, they're not referring to the grassroots activists or parties like the Civic Alliance. They're talking to people who, if they were in Rome, according to a lot of people here, they would do as the Romans are doing.
And, Jeremy, there have been a couple of developments in terms of the European Union that are especially interesting. One is that the European Union has said that it will not help Yugoslavia to rebuild as long as Milosevic remains in power. At the same time, the European Union announced yesterday that it will begin forming its own military force of the Union, which would seem to indicate an attempt to definitely become much more independent of the United States as a military force. What's been the reaction in Belgrade to these announcements?
Well, that's been a major discussion, particularly among the opposition parties, is how is Yugoslavia going to be rebuilt? Some of the parties are calling for elections within 30 days of the halting of the bombing. Others say that they could foresee a six-month timetable. But across the board, people believe that this bombing has strengthened Milosevic's grip on power here, has strengthened his standing within government circles here as sort of a symbol of defiance to the United States and Britain. This agreement may change that, so it's not clear how this will exactly affect that. But one opposition person told me today that he felt that Milosevic was going to become the CEO of Yugoslavia under the control of the United States and Britain, making the country safe for foreign investment, that they believe that Milosevic is ready to play ball with the corporations, with the IMF, and certainly with the United States.
Jeremy, also in the studio with us, we're joined by Catholic Bishop Thomas Gumbleton of Detroit, and he's in Washington because yesterday he participated in a protest. And in one of the rare moments in the corporate media, I'm actually not only looking at his face in front of me in person in Washington, but I'm looking at a photograph of him in the Washington Post. Okay, albeit it's on page 829, where it says 26 arrested in protest at White House. Religious peace groups urge end to bombing. And I wanted you also to be able to hear what Bishop Gumbleton has to say. Bishop Gumbleton, you were getting arrested as President Clinton was making the announcement that they were cautiously optimistic that the bombing would end. Why get arrested?
Well, of course, at that moment, we didn't know that the president was making the statement. We were out on the street. And yet, I still feel the protest was very important and needs the protest tomorrow at the Pentagon, I think, should still go on because we haven't stopped the bombing. And I find that my major reaction to this whole thing is I feel ashamed of the United States for what we have done to Serbia. And we have imposed our will on NATO and on Serbia and Yugoslavia. And we've come out, I guess, feeling like we're strong. We really prove we can do what we want to do, no matter, from my point of view, it's without any regard for the loss of human life, the destruction of the infrastructure of Serbia and all the suffering that has already gone on and that will continue to go on. And I think, long term, what the United States has done in this instance is something that we were planning for a number of months. Last time I was going to Iraq, I happened to pick up an International Herald Tribune, and the front page headline article is U.S. urging allies to refocus NATO. And the article goes on to explain what the U.S. is trying to do with NATO now to extend it beyond Europe to enable us to dominate not only Europe, and previously we were focused against the Soviet Union, but now we're moving to make NATO a force to impose our will on the Middle East. And I think our military people are going to feel very happy about this, and maybe our political leaders too. But I feel very distraught and dismayed over that, because it's just another instance to me of the U.S. trying to impose its will on the rest of the world and dominate the world economically, and then if that doesn't always work, militarily.
Well, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. And Jeremy, we want to thank you for being with us. Any last words from Belgrade before we leave you for the weekend?
Yeah, two short things, Amy. The first is that Bishop Gumbelton should be happy to know that in the Yugoslav papers today, that demonstration was covered on page 3, and some of the Plowshares activists who participated in that action, Sister Artis Platy and Sister Carol Gilbert and another Catholic worker, Michael Wally, there was a picture of them in the main Serbian newspaper today, Blitz, and a short article about the protest. The second thing is, I've talked to several economists here who say that this country has been set back several decades economically, that the damage is so extensive that it is almost irreparable in any near future. The bridges, the electrical supplies, the hospitals, they feel that the civilian infrastructure was not collateral damage, that it was targeted. And they feel that this agreement that was signed continues to be no good for the people here, and begs the question, why did this happen in the first place, just to sign this agreement?
Well, Jeremy, thanks for being with us from Belgrade. Jeremy Scahill reporting from Yugoslavia. And as we go to the break, Bishop Gumbelton is shaking his head and saying Iraq. And we'll come back to this discussion with the bishop when we return. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
You're listening to Democracy Now! This is Juan Gonzalez in New York with Amy Goodman in Washington. And we're talking with Bishop Thomas Gumbelton of the Archdiocese of Detroit. Bishop Gumbelton, I'd like to ask you two questions that are particularly bothersome to me. Is one, the increasing ability of our political leaders through the use of high-tech weaponry to conduct devastating wars abroad while having almost no repercussions in terms of casualties or even massive concern in the United States, and what that means for the future of politics and war making by our country. I know Amy raised that in her interview on C-SPAN this morning, and also the other is the increasing pressure by obviously military companies to continue to find enemies for our country, so to justify increased expenditures on weapons.
Those are two concerns that I have. The long-term outcome of this effort. And first of all, about the United States, I find it very discouraging that more people in the U.S. don't seem to be aware or let themselves become aware of what goes on when we use those high-tech weapons. We totally destroyed Iraq 9 years ago. We've continued to destroy Iraq through the sanctions over these last 9 years. We've left a country that is devastated, 5,000 people dying every month. And yet, it's very difficult to get anybody in this country to be truly concerned and demand that stop. And now we've done it again. We leave another country in total disarray and destroyed, set back, as you said, or Jeremy said, many decades. And I'm sure the people of the U.S. will simply forget about this in a very short time. And it enables our political leaders then to continue to do what whatever they feel we need to do to keep United States, as Madam Albright says, number one. And, you know, we're the nation that stands tall, and we see further into the future than anybody else, and so therefore we have to use violence whenever we decide. And that I find just a terrible, evil description of the U.S., and yet it's one that I'm, you know, it's made by one of our own political leaders, and I'm sure she's correct in what she says. I mean, her attitude toward what we as a nation are, and that's what our political leaders think, and I find that I'm ashamed, as I said at the beginning, that we would be a nation like this. I wish we would have more of a genuine concern for the peoples of the world and not continue simply to try to dominate through our economic might and our military might.
Bishop Gumbelton, what is the position of the Catholic Bishops' Conference? You're an auxiliary bishop of Detroit. I know that last weekend, John Cardinal O'Connor of New York spoke out against the bombing of Yugoslavia. Has the overall Bishops' Conference made a statement?
The Bishops' Conference did make a statement a few weeks ago, but it was the kind of a statement where we raised questions and said perhaps we need to look at this or look at that and so on, that maybe this war isn't a just war. It wasn't an explicit condemnation of the war. Such as the Pope has made consistently, or as now more recently Cardinal O'Connor did. And I find that very disappointing, and also that other religious leaders throughout this country have not stood up explicitly condemning what is going on as a moral outrage. I think that's what it is, and we ought to be naming it that way.
Well, tomorrow I know there will be a major protest in Washington. Democracy Now! Will be there covering it as people march from the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, starting at noon with Ron Kovic giving a speech there, well known because the movie The Fourth of July is based on his life as a Vietnam veteran, a man who lost his legs to that war. And then they're marching over to the Pentagon, and people like Ramsey Clark are going to be giving major addresses. You'll be sending greetings because you have to go back to Detroit. But what about religious leaders, and what kind of, you know, one of the questions that was asked on C-SPAN by listeners calling in is, what is the peace movement today? Who calls themselves a peace activist? And would you say that it is intact?
Well, the peace movement is still there, and there are many different peace groups. There were 18 represented yesterday in the protest, and yet it's been difficult to get the peace movement focused very clearly. I suppose it's much like the problems the United States has. We always have to have, the country has to have an enemy. And so when the Soviet Union collapsed, we create other enemies, and then it keeps the military-industrial complex going. Well, in the past few years, the peace movement hasn't had as clear a focus as what we are trying to be against. And then it's even more difficult to focus on how you truly build peace and get people mobilized behind a movement to build peace, because that's so complex, and it's very complicated to do that, because there are so many elements that are necessary to build peace. And so it's been difficult to get the peace movement truly focused. But I think we have a major task in front of us to do that, because otherwise the U.S., empire, as I would call it, is simply going to try to take over the world for our own benefit. And I know a lot of people are outraged when you say such a thing or suggest that we're becoming an imperial power dominating other nations and other peoples. But that is clearly what's happening. And no empire is good. And we will not be a good empire when that happens.
Well, Bishop Gumbelton, one of the things that appears to me to be a difference, let's say, between the role of the church in areas like Central America, where obviously the Catholic Church and other religious leaders, many were active and helped to build a very strong movement against U.S. policy in Central America, whereas you haven't seen that kind of a moral force being built around Iraq or even around what's going on in Yugoslavia. Could it be that perhaps the church itself, the Catholic Church and other U.S.-based churches don't have that much of a presence within these countries, so that there's a back and flow of information and resistance from church members in those countries and aligning with the church members in this country?
Well, what happened in Central America and other parts of Latin America is that the church became much more identified with those who were oppressed and who were being deprived of their rights. And so the church was in solidarity with them and became very active in the struggle for liberation for those people, to free them from their oppression. In our country, the church is not identified with the poor or the oppressed. Within the United States itself, the institutional churches, for the most part, are not, and I say this explicitly about the Catholic Church, we simply are not present, truly present, in where the poor and the oppressed are in this country. And then we don't have the kind of contact with the poor and the oppressed, you know, the two-thirds of the people of the world who are poverty-stricken and in many cases oppressed. We are not actively engaged with them. And so we don't have the same intense determination to try to free these people, to liberate them from their oppression. And that's a failure. Our basic mandate within the Catholic Church is the mandate that comes back from or comes out of the scriptures, where Jesus himself said, "I came to proclaim good news to the poor, to set the downtrodden free, to heal the brokenhearted." That's what we're supposed to be doing, and we're not doing it. And I find that a massive failure on the part of the Catholic Church and, I would say, other institutional religious groups.
Bishop Gumbleton, how many times have you been arrested?
I'm not sure. It's probably a dozen or so. Most of them previously had been at nuclear test sites in the effort to stop the continuing development of our nuclear arsenal, which goes on. And I've been arrested in those kinds of situations. But then more recently now with regard to Iraq and now the Serbian war. So it's probably a dozen times or so.
You're certainly an outspoken critic of the U.S. administration. You were recently on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer in their show on the anti-war movement. Unfortunately, what happens is when there is a big enough movement, you get some minutes on a show, as opposed to these leading dissident voices in the country like yours being incorporated into the daily discourse of all the different programs.
Yeah, you're right. That simply doesn't happen.
How often have you been called since the bombing began 73 days ago to be in the corporate media?
I think probably Jim Lehrer was the first time in the, you know, there have been small notices in newspapers when something, an arrest or a protest or something like that. But and again, that's part of the problem. The U.S. government controls the media, and the corporate structures of our country control the media. So the message only goes out that our government wants the people to hear. I mean, it is so clear that what happened during the Serbian war, the only thing you saw in the media, what was happening to the Kosovars, and that was dreadful and just really upset many, many people. But if we'd been showing the same sorts of things about what was happening in Serbia, there would have been a massive protest against that war. But our government has learned from the Vietnam War that it has to control the media. In fact, I read an article in the paper recently that the military now plan how the war is going to appear on television. And they plan the war in such a way so that it will appear on television in a way that will only promote the continuation of that war. And so they know what they're doing, and they won't allow this other voice to be heard. And that's a very terrible thing, or, you know, disappointing thing to have to say about our country, where freedom of the press is supposed to be one of our major rights and one of the things that's a foundation for our type of government.
Well, Bishop Gumbleton, in line with that, what impact do you think the decision of the government in Yugoslavia to allow a free access to U.S. media to cover the war from inside of Yugoslavia had on U.S. public opinion? I mean, my sense of it is that the Pentagon did not expect that American reporters would have such open access within Serbia and even in areas of Kosovo to be able to report on the impact of the war.
Well, I'm sure our government was concerned about that and wished it had not happened. On the other hand, the editors back here in this country, I don't think used nearly what they could have used, especially in the television medium, if scenes of what was going on in Serbia were shown every night on national news. Again, there would have been tremendous outrage in this country and a reaction against that. But it simply wasn't being shown. And so even though the reporters are there, reporters don't control what the editors decide to put in the papers or to put on the TV.
I think it's always interesting when you see the reporting from Kosovo and Yugoslavia, that when you see the reporting from Kosovo and Yugoslavia, they would often be qualified by saying this is what Yugoslav sources and censors are allowing you to see. But we don't see it on the other side, either the qualification of the footage all the time. Sometimes you do. This is NATO footage of the dropping of the bomb. And also, basically, whether or not NATO says you can do this or you can't do this, really, is the coverage any different from them actually laying down out the law?
Yeah, that's exactly my point. You've made it very well. Yeah.
Well, I know that you have to catch a flight. We want to thank you for postponing your flight to join us today. And also let people know again that tomorrow there is a major march in Washington, D.C., from the Vietnam Veterans Memorial to the Pentagon. And this as while peace is being discussed, as Jeremy told us so often from Belgrade, the joke in Belgrade is as diplomatic talks intensify, people understand that bombing intensifies as well.
Yeah. So thank you very much. I'm happy to have been here today.
Thank you, Bishop Gumbleton, Auxiliary Bishop of Detroit, Bishop Thomas Gumbleton, also pictured in the Washington Post today. Quite a surprise. And I want to comment that he's pictured in the Post with Dominican sister Ardith Plotty of Baltimore, who is part of Jonah House. And we have been joined by members of Jonah House, like Phil Berrigan and others in the last few weeks, letting us know that U.S. administration and authorities are trying to break up this house of peace activists as people come out of jail because they have hammered on warheads or thrown their blood on warheads, saying that Jonah House is a house of continued criminal activity. Although they do not indict people there right now, they are preventing people from returning to their homes once they leave prison, and that situation continues. In fact, we had word just about a week ago that the U.S. Marshals moved in on one of the members of Jonah House. But right now we're going to go to another issue that is still also part of the military-industrial complex. The United States is the wealthiest country in the world, yet social needs programs such as food stamps, legal services, housing assistance for the poor represent only 4% of the federal budget, while military expenditures make up over half, already $300 billion in 98 alone. Well, today, with the privatization of social services by state and municipal governments, weapons manufacturers are also profiting from running these programs. Lockheed Martin, best known for building menacing weapons systems and for receiving billions of dollars in corporate welfare, has been awarded contracts to run welfare-to-work programs in Washington, D.C., California, and Florida. This was a major story in the City Paper this week that's authored by Alyssa Silverman, associate editor of the Washington City Paper. She recently wrote an extensive expose on Lockheed's involvement in city and state programs such as workfare. Welcome to Democracy Now, Alyssa.
Thanks, Amy.
Before we go to our break, just summarize what this report is about.
Well, as you said, the rage for privatizing municipal services is very strong. And especially in a place like Washington, D.C., where residents have complained about dysfunction, poor delivery of municipal services. And Lockheed has jumped in and said, this is a place where we can make a profit. And they have stepped in very big in Washington, not only in things like parking meters, collections of parking tickets, but also, surprisingly, in welfare to work.
Well, before we go to welfare to work, can you explain the parking meter? I mean, this was shocking when I read this. If someone pays a parking ticket, what percentage of it goes to Lockheed Martin?
Well, it depends upon the contract. In D.C., what happens is if you don't pay your parking ticket, then Lockheed jumps in and makes a profit off of trying to collect the tickets in arrears. And I think in D.C. they make about $250 for every ticket that they can collect. Plus they also have a fee for just processing the tickets as well.
So this is a major U.S. weapons manufacturer being responsible for the collection of tickets and, more importantly, for workfare. And we're going to talk about that in just a minute with you and some other guests. Alyssa Silverman is the associate editor of Washington's City Paper and did a very interesting piece called Bombs Away. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and we'll be back in a minute.
In the far off land, Uncle Sam does the best he can.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman in Washington with Juan Gonzalez in New York, and we're talking about military weapons contractors not actually bombing Yugoslavia, but their involvement in welfare here at home, the welfare and workfare programs. Our guest, Alyssa Silverman, who did the piece Bombs Away in the City Paper, a community newspaper in Washington, D.C., which investigated Lockheed Martin's involvement in Washington, D.C.'s welfare to work program. We also should say that we have invited Lockheed Martin to join us, but they said they wouldn't have involvement with anything City Paper had involvement with, even though you, Alyssa, did interview Lockheed Martin. And we're also joined in our New York and Washington studios by Gary Shores, labor economist with the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, as well as Bill Hartung, who's with the World Policy Institute at the New School for Social Research, who's looked at Lockheed Martin's warfare to welfare program. Alyssa Martin, workfare in Washington.
Well, Lockheed, in November of 97, Lockheed, the district privatized its welfare to work program and awarded $52 million in welfare to work contracts to eight vendors, the biggest contract by far. Was Lockheed Martin. They received $33 million. Now, I should say that that's a performance-based contract, so it is based on their performance of moving. They're paid per person to move people into the workforce. But as the article points out, there are possible problems with the incentives given to Lockheed as far as how they do that.
Well, Alyssa, in terms of that being a performance-based contract, does that mean that the quality of the job or the longevity of the person on that job is also factored into the performance, or is it just a question of how many bodies you move immediately into a minimum wage job?
It is. The way the contract is structured is that Lockheed is given a certain financial reward, in this case $500, just to move people into the workplace, to get them off the welfare rolls and into a job. And then if that person retains the job in 3 months and then 6 months, Lockheed is given a certain financial reward at those points. But it's interesting because as I looked around the country, each state has done a different, you know, has a different reward for job retention. And in fact, in other states, the emphasis is more on just moving people into the roles more than even D.C.'s. So D.C. actually doesn't have that bad of an incentive for job retention.
Gary Shores, your labor economist with the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, more familiarly known as AFSCME, can you talk about Lockheed Martin's hiring of a large number of former city and state employees?
Yeah. Lockheed has hired a lot of folks. We sort of call it the revolving door, and that's one of the things that calls into question the process that they go through for getting these contracts. They very commonly hire high-level state and local officials, and of course that brings up the question of, do they have sort of an inside track? In Texas, that was a notable problem. Some critics basically asked if the contract wasn't, quote, wired for Lockheed.
I think it's important to bring up that, for example, the person who directs Lockheed's welfare reform services is Jerry Miller, who's the former director of Michigan's Welfare to Work program. And, you know, Michigan was on the forefront of privatizing welfare services, and he was an advisor to the House Republicans on welfare reform.
We also have here in New York Bill Hartung with the World Policy Institute. And, Bill, I'd like to ask you, in terms of the implications for this continued privatization of government services and an involvement of for-profit companies in delivering these services, what has been the impact nationwide on the quality of service delivery to the public?
Well, the interesting thing about privatization is there's this assumption that private companies are more efficient, but they're not held to the same standards that government is held to. So, for example, Maximus, which is a private company running welfare in part of Milwaukee, was sued by a welfare recipient because she said her case was not handled properly. And they didn't want to yield up the files. They said, well, that's our information. We don't have to give that to you. A government agency could never make that kind of bald-faced statement. Similarly, in Texas, when they were bidding to run the welfare program there, Lockheed Martin actually, for a year while the contract was under bid, the state of Texas would not let any member of the public or any member of the state legislature attend those proceedings as to how they were planning to restructure the welfare system for the entire state of Texas. And their argument was, well, we don't want the losing bidder to sue us, and so we have to keep a closed process. So what appears to be happening is these private companies are saying they're coming to these states, which can't deal with the new welfare bill because they have to track people, file reports, get new computers. They don't have the money to do it. A company like Lockheed Martin says, hey, we'll take the problem off your hands. We'll put in the computers. We'll make the reports to the government. We'll divert the people from the roles, and we'll take a cut off the top. So a lot of these legislatures are like, great, you know, if you'll get us out of this mess, we'll let you do it. But it comes at the cost of accountability, that not only now do you have to deal with City Hall and the state capitol, but now you got to deal with Lockheed Martin when your rights are violated. And that's a very tough combination to deal with.
You know, you mentioned Texas, Bill Hartung, and of course Texas is the state of Governor George W. Bush. Can you talk about, as you did in your piece in The Nation, Lockheed Martin from Warfare to Welfare, Bush's connection to the privatization of social services?
Well, it was a great little story. You know, Bush had a legislative liaison, sort of his main guy in the state capitol in Austin, named Dan Shelley. Dan Shelley was the one who wrote the provision in the state welfare law that called for what was originally supposed to be just a study of the possibility of privatizing welfare. But basically, he wrote it in such a way that it turned into a full-blown plan to have a private company be the first point of contact if you wanted to get food stamps, Medicaid, welfare. You would go to a Lockheed Martin office instead of a state of Texas office. And Shelley, about 6 months after that, went to work for Lockheed Martin as a lobbyist, as did the wife of one of the former state officials, as did six or seven other state officials. And even in Texas, which does not have, let us say, strong conflict of interest rules, people were shocked at how brazen Lockheed Martin was in their influence peddling. And this is basically why they're in this area, because they know how to do one thing. They know how to lobby the government for contracts. They may not know how to feed or help people or get them jobs, but they certainly know how to hire former government officials. And it's a lot cheaper to buy off social service officials than it is to buy off former generals, because they don't make that much. You know, they've hired people from Oregon, Arkansas, who are making $20,000-$25,000. You know, they give them six figures, and they're kissing their feet. So, and then they use these people as front people. You know, they put them in Governing magazine with pictures. They hired an African American woman who used to run some of the social service programs in Connecticut. She's the new, you know, human face of Lockheed Martin when it comes to social services. So, I think Bush is going to have a lot to answer for if people look into the corrupt bargain that he almost struck in the state of Texas. And the only reason he didn't get away with it is because the Texas State Employees Union and the welfare groups essentially embarrassed him out of doing it by exposing this influence peddling scheme.
And Bill, is Lockheed the only company or weapons manufacturer that's gotten into this area, or are there others also that have staked out claims?
Lockheed Martin is the biggest one, because they bought Datacom, which was one of the companies involved in the New York City parking violation scandal, and they've built that into this whole information management services unit. But companies like Raytheon are bidding on contracts with municipalities, Unisys, which has government computer contracts for the military and others. So there's a there's some presence of these military contractors and contractors that have done work for the FBI and law enforcement. There's a guy who writes for one of the Florida papers who said when he realized, you know, all these different government areas that Lockheed Martin was involved in, they're going to be involved in the year 2000 census. They may be involved in electronic processing of tax forms for the IRS. He said, you know, I was always wondering who was going to become Big Brother. I think Lockheed Martin is it. And if they succeed in getting involved in all these areas, there's going to be all kinds of conflicts, all kinds of issues of privacy, all kinds of power they're going to have over people's lives. And we may or may not have access even to their records to know what they're you know, doing with this information or doing to these government programs.
We're talking to Bill Hartung with the World Policy Institute. Alyssa Silverman, associate editor for the City Paper, has a piece, Bombs Away, that exposes Lockheed Martin's involvement in so many social services, workfare, as well as parking violations and parking programs. And Gary Shores, labor economist with the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, AFSCME. Gary, why is AFSCME involved with this story?
Well, one of the reasons is because we represent a lot of the public sector employees who provide welfare services and so on. But more generally, we think that these are crucial government functions that it's just plain wrong to privatize. You know, it's been said that society should be judged based on how well it takes care of the poor and the disabled and so on. And I really don't think that Lockheed Martin is the most qualified to take care of those functions. And in fact, beyond the whole issue of privatization and whether it's right or wrong, when you look at the performance of the company, you know, it's subpar. In Maryland, for example, the company was given a child support enforcement contract in Baltimore City, and it was handily beaten by AFSCME members, public employees, in another county, in Washington County. And the company sort of argued that those were not fair comparisons. But the fact is the company knew what it was getting into when it entered the contract. I mean, that's one of the things about the company, too, that's very striking is that it's expert at writing contracts, or negotiating good contracts, I should say, and it will pursue the money in the contracts. In Florida, another example, the state was most interested in collections, in other words, actually collecting from so-called deadbeat parents in child support, but the company basically pursued case closing fees, and it found that that's sort of where the money, the quick money was, and that's what it did. And
what's a case closing fee?
In other words, the company was paid a variable fee for closing a case, as in closing a file on an individual so-called deadbeat parent, deadbeat dad. And when they found, when the company found that it was difficult to actually collect money, it sort of, you know, reconfigured itself, pursuing the case closing fees that could, you know, fatten its bottom line, basically.
Alyssa,
I think that Gary gets to the very important point about incentives. And in child support, the example Gary gives is that instead of going for the harder cases to track down the money, what Lockheed, I believe, did in Florida was just say, well, let's go for the easiest cases where we can make the quickest money, and we're going to ignore the section of the child support caseload, which is the hard to track down parents who don't have money to give to their children. And that's true, and that's what we put up flags about in the welfare contract in D.C. as well, that, you know, half the people on the welfare rolls and the people that I was able to interview, these are people who are interested in getting back into the workforce. They're motivated. They're probably going to get there without, although they claim now it's harder, they're probably going to get into the workforce anyway. But it's the other 50% of the welfare rolls that's much harder to employ that Lockheed's probably just going to throw up their hands and say, well, we can't make a profit off these people. We're going to ignore them. And that's, you know, what we're really, I think, should be concerned about.
Alyssa, in your article in the City paper, you mentioned that Lockheed collects 20% of delinquent child support across the country, totaling nearly $5 billion. What kind of a return or a revenue stream do they get themselves from this particular service?
Sure. It's variable contract to contract, but it's anywhere between, for every dollar they collect, it's about they retain about 15 to 20 cents of that dollar.
And I wanted to follow up with Bill Hartung. In your piece, now you're saying the Texas privatization plan known as TIES, Texas Integrated Enrollment System, did not go through?
Well, no. What happened was they needed a waiver from President Clinton because they wanted not only to be the point of contact for welfare, but also food stamps and Medicaid. And federal law was pretty clear that at least for food stamps and Medicaid, that had to be done by a merit system employee, a government employee, unless they could get a waiver from the federal government. So after doing the typical Clinton thing of, you know, sticking his finger in the wind for 8 or 10 months, he finally, under pressure from some of the national unions and social service groups, decided, well, we don't want to go that far yet. And so then Lockheed Martin said, well, you know, if it's only welfare, we're not as interested. Meanwhile, the Texas state legislature was offended, you know, even some of the conservatives, that they were sort of shut out of this process. And so for the moment, they've gone for a more modest scheme where EDS, Ross Perot's old company, is redoing the state's computers for its social services and is going to do some sort of pilot plan. So now Lockheed Martin is bidding for some of these welfare-to-work contracts city by city and county by county. So they haven't given up on Texas, but they didn't get the one big, you know, payoff that they were hoping for.
And what's
but I do have to say, I was just shocked by the fact that, okay, they need a waiver to get to cover determine eligibility for Medicaid and food stamps, but they didn't need a waiver to determine eligibility for cash assistance for welfare. This is a private company, not just giving out the money, but determining eligibility. You would think the government would be doing that.
Yeah, that was supposed to be the plan, but the new welfare law is a big, you know, you can drive a truck through it in terms of that stuff. So.
And Bill, in terms of which state has is furthest along in terms of this use of private corporations to handle these services for the poor or in welfare?
Well, in Wisconsin, they've doled up Milwaukee into sort of six quadrants, and at least one of them is now being totally handled by a private company, Maximus. Florida has done quite a bit, and Lockheed Martin's got a lot of contracts down there. Arizona had a big plan on the agenda, but some of the progressive groups have made their voices heard and put some limits on how far they can go at the moment. But essentially, there's a lot going on in the southern states, but also in New York State, for example. Lockheed Martin has a contract as a subcontractor to Citibank for something called electronic benefits transfers, which is when you go to use your food stamps, you would use sort of like an ATM card instead of actual pieces of paper. And in theory, fine, it's more convenient, whatever. But the problem is some people are not experienced in using those cards. If there's a mistake, it's very hard to get your benefits back. Lockheed Martin has mostly been talking to bodega owners about giving them money to put the machines in. They have spent very little time, which they're supposed to be doing, talking to the benefit recipients about how to use the cards correctly, how to make sure they're not cheated out of their benefits. So again, they're sort of following the money, and the big money is get the money to put in these machines, not teach people their rights. So,
Gary Storrs, a last 10-second comment.
Well, I was just going to follow up on some earlier comments. Basically, Lockheed follows the money. It says that it wants to do things for children and so on, but when the profit picture begins to look bleak, like in Texas or Florida, it abandons ship, so to speak.
Well, on that note, we want to thank you all for joining us. Gary Storrs is labor economist with the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. Ask me. Alyssa Silverman, associate editor for City Paper. Her piece is called Bombs Away. Is there a website, Alyssa?
Sure. You just go to our website, www.washingtoncitypaper.com. You'll actually click on the current cover story. We already have next week's cover story up, but if you go, it will be in the archives.
And Bill Hartung with World Policy Institute at the New School for Social Research. Thank you, Bill.
Thanks.
And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland's our technical director. Joe Gill, engineered from WPFW in Washington. Special thanks to Dan Coughlin. I'm Amy Goodman in Washington with Juan Gonzalez in New York for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!